Now then, a very good morning to you. It is Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. Tell you what, it's very mild out there this morning. It is very, very mild. That is nice. Just returned from my usual morning walk with the puppies and very pleasant, very pleasant. Hope it's good wherever you are. Thank you for listening to this podcast. I appreciate it. I'm going straight to the front pages of the UK dailies then, and tabloids and broadsheets. The Guardian. Tory donors' remarks were racist and wrong. Number 10. Right, you'll know about this now. Frank Hester, a huge donor, a man who has given £10 million to the Conservative Party, made recorded remarks about Diane Abbott, who was the first black woman to become an MP in the UK. He said that she, Abbott, made him want to hate all black women. The interesting thing about this yesterday was how long it took for number 10, for Rishi Sunak, to come out and say, yes, these remarks were wrong and racist, and the Labour Party is making much capital out of this. We'll come back to it briefly in a few minutes, but many of the front pages are leading with or referencing this particular story, this donor who made these remarks about Diane Abbott. There have been calls for the Conservative Party to return the money donated to it by this man, Frank Hester. The Oi. Sunak bows to Tory pressure to admit donor was racist. Yeah, there you go again. Okay. The Times. Rwanda plan will offer migrants £3,000 to leave. We'll come back to this for sure. No doubt about it. The Times also, on the front page, has this: NHS bans puberty blockers for gender change children. And again, we'll certainly come back to that. Daily Express: Boris vows to campaign on great Brexit freedom. So the Express says that Boris Johnson will hit the campaign trail at the next general election in support of hard-won Brexit freedoms. Johnson is going to ride to the rescue of the Tory party. That's the claim in the Express. A number of similar claims have been made in recent days. Rishi Sunak is very quiet, though, when he's asked about Boris Johnson. He doesn't say very much. And one of Johnson's friends, Nadine Dorries, of course, also a recent Tory MP, Dorries has said that he's enjoying his life too much to want to return to politics, to frontline politics. I suppose we'll have to wait and see. There's a Daily Telegraph headline, and we will return to this as well. Starmer will allow assisted dying vote. Starmer will allow assisted dying vote. That's important. Also on the front page of the Telegraph, and we'll come back to this too, COVID inquiry is fundamentally biased, scientists warn. Yes, we'll come back to that. Daily Mail: what have they done with our loved ones' bodies? This is a terrible story, which I've been hearing about the last couple of days. I haven't dived right into it or delved too deeply into it, but it's about a funeral director in Hull, where more than 1,000 people have contacted a police hotline set up as part of an investigation into a family funeral director in Hull. Yesterday, the police said they'd removed 35 bodies and a quantity of ashes from legacy independent funeral directors because of concerns over the care of the deceased. The paper says the Mail: dozens of families whose loved ones were handled by this firm have been left agonising over whether the bodies of their loved ones were ever actually cremated or if they received the wrong ashes. It's a terrible story, this. Terrible. Terrible thing. We've all known, we all know what it's like to lose someone you love, someone dying who you loved very dearly. And to think that, you know, the firm that you trusted to take care of them, their remains, might be badly run or worse, making mistakes and giving you the wrong remains and all sorts. It's a terrible story. A number of newspapers covering it today, like the Daily Mirror, for example. Heartbreak and horror is the headline. One woman has told the Daily Mirror she fears for what was done with the remains of her brother and father. It's like something out of a horror movie, the woman has told the Mirror. The Metro, three held over £76 million care home con. What's that about? Well, it's a story about three people having been arrested as part of an investigation into possible fraud following the collapse even of a care home firm that had spent money on a private jet, two yachts and numerous luxury cars. The paper says the Carloran Group went into administration despite raising £76 million from investors, forcing elderly residents to leave the company's homes. Yeah. The Sun. Paul leaves £125,000 to his dogs. This is Paul O'Grady, television presenter, entertainer, was known for the character Lily Savage. He was a drag act at one stage. O'Grady has left £125,000 in his will to pay for the care of his five pet dogs. The paper says the broadcaster, who died last year, left another £500,000 of his estate to Battersea Dogs and Cats Home. Good for him. The Financial Times. Inflation's rise to 3.2% challenges Fed stamina for last mile in prices battle. That's a story about US inflation. The Daily Star headline is Oink. Oink, Piggy Britain is the headline on the Star front page. The story is about table manners and how table manners have disappeared as people are increasingly chewing with their mouths open and won't ever put their phones down. Oink is the headline. I've read many a time in recent years that sitting down to dinner at the dinner table is a dying thing in any case. Well, it's something that doesn't happen as often as maybe it used to. Most families, it's been claimed, watch the TV while having their dinner with a TV tray in their laps. Right, okay, this is the papers. Let's go inside. And there are some very interesting stories in the papers. Let's go with the front page of the Telegraph. COVID inquiry appears fundamentally biased, say scientists, who are warning about the failure to examine the costs of lockdown. So this is a letter which has been written to Baroness Hallett, the inquiry chairwoman. A group of 55 professors and academics have expressed their concerns that the process is not living up to its mission to evaluate the mistakes made during the pandemic, assess whether COVID measures were appropriate, and to prepare the country for the next pandemic. These academics and scientists are warning that, quote, a lack of neutrality means the inquiry gives the impression of being fundamentally biased and appears to have led to predetermined conclusions, for example, to lock down faster next time. So this is very interesting. Now, what it will lead to or what it means, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. They published the letter yesterday, the one sent to Hallett. They say, the group, that the inquiry is neglecting to hear evidence from those who suffered from the negative effects of pandemic policy decisions or scientists who disagree with choices made by the government. As the second module of the inquiry comes to a close, they call for this to be urgently addressed and greater focus to be placed on the economic and social cost of COVID policies to British societies. Now, interestingly enough, as this letter was published yesterday, the chairman of the Office for Budget Responsibility, a guy called Richard Hughes, he's warned that worklessness had become a worrying trend in the economy since the pandemic. He was appearing before the Treasury Select Committee and he told them the economy had been growing as a result of net migration, but now it was suffering from a reversal in its workforce amid rising levels of inactivity and a falling participation rate. He told the Treasury Select Committee that it looks, this is a quote, as though persistently high levels of inactivity seem to be a feature of the post-pandemic environment and one which is worrying from the point of view of human welfare. Now, the Telegraph says, so far, the COVID inquiry has examined the government's resilience and preparedness, as well as decision-making and political governance across the UK. The next set of inquiry modules include one on the government's business and financial response. Another module focuses on education, or will focus on education, children and young people. Academics hope the cost of lockdown policies will be scrutinised more closely in these upcoming sections of the inquiry. So who are these 55 people who have written to say they're worried that the inquiry is fundamentally biased and isn't examining the harms of lockdown, and even if lockdown was appropriate or necessary? Well, they include academics from York, Durham, Bristol and Exeter universities, as well as Imperial College London and King's College London. Their fields range from global health policy and medicine to ethics, law and statistics. Yes, Kevin Bardosh is one of these signatories. He's director of Collateral Global, a British think tank which was set up to examine pandemic policies. He's told The Telegraph that he wanted to write to Baroness Hallett before the list of core participants is drawn up for the next set of modules. Now, while anyone can submit evidence to the inquiry, core participant groups enjoy special status, including the right to representation and the ability to make legal submissions, suggest questions for witnesses and receive disclosure of documentation. Now, Dr. Bardosh has said the letter is an attempt to get the inquiry to recognise that they have got some things wrong. They still have time to redirect it to be more impartial. It's important they recognise the inquiry. They have had these biases and shortcomings in modules 1 and 2, so they don't carry it over into the other modules. The letter accuses the inquiry of taking key assumptions for granted instead of examining and critiquing them. This is an important article in The Telegraph. And yes, there's no doubt that the COVID inquiry is a whitewash. It began with predetermined conclusions, no doubt about it, that lockdown should have happened quicker and it should have been harder. And that's what these academics are saying, that this is terribly wrong and it needs to be dealt with ahead of the forthcoming modules. Will it make any difference? I don't know. I doubt it very much. We'll see if these academics receive a response from the chairwoman of the inquiry. Let's have a look at a story in The Guardian. It's the front page story. Tory donors' comments about Diane Abbott, racist and wrong. Number 10 says, Frank Hester, the businessman, said in a meeting nearly 5 years ago, that looking at Labour MP Diane Abbott made you want to hate all black women, and he said the MP should be shot. Now, she released a statement yesterday. She said it's very concerning. She said she's a single woman who travels on public transport in London, and as an MP and as a single female MP, she feels pretty vulnerable in any case. And this isn't good, because we've seen back in 2016, before the Brexit referendum, the murder of Joe Cox, and more recently the murder of the MP Sir David Amos. He was murdered in his constituency office. She says this isn't a good time to be making references to people being shot, whether you mean it or whether you don't. Hester gave 10 million quid to the Conservative Party. There have been calls for him to give it back. Senior politicians, say The Guardian, from across the political spectrum piled pressure on Rishi Sunak to intervene. What do I think about this? What do I think about it? Is Frank Hester racist? I don't know, because I don't know Frank Hester. Can comments such as those be construed as racist? Well, obviously, yes, they bloody well can. Looking at a black woman makes me want to hate all black women, even if he's joking. The fact is, people are entitled, I think, to hear those or view those comments and say, well, they're problematic. Maybe this guy is racist, but maybe he isn't. I don't know the guy. What was interesting yesterday was black Tory MPs like Kemi Badenoch, the business secretary, and Kwasi Kwarteng, the former chancellor, they came out and said, look, these comments are certainly racist, you know. He's got to apologise, and if he does, and what if it's sincere, we'll move on. But number 10 didn't. It was only late last evening that number 10 came out and said that the comments are indeed racist and wrong. But they went on to say that his remorse should be accepted after he rightly apologised. The statement from number 10 went on to say that Sunak is clear there is no place for racism in public life, and he is the first British Asian Prime Minister leading an ethnically diverse cabinet, or one of the most ethnically diverse cabinets in our history. The UK is living proof of that fact. But also in The Guardian today is another story about Frank Hester. The Guardian is claiming an exclusive. They say that he asked one time during a crowded meeting if there was no room for the Indians, and he suggested that staff climb on a train roof during this crowded meeting before saying that he made a lot of jokes about racism. He also said he wanted to find jokes about Malaysian people during a trip to the country. He runs a major healthcare technology firm, the Phoenix Partnership, TPP, which is contracted to work for the NHS, Department of Health and Social Care. That's a payoff, I suppose, for his £10 million donation. Now, that is far more interesting to me than this guy making stupid jokes about racism in meetings, you know, that might reveal this guy to be racist or not, because I don't know the guy. I know that we throw around accusations of racism far too easily these days as a way of shutting people up. You know, people who might be making comments on other issues, or who might have insights into other issues that we talk about on shows like The Richie Allen Show. Shutting them down. Everything is racist these days. I get it. I get it. And it's becoming more and more common as a way of completely silencing people and cancelling them by taking some abstract comment they made, declaring that person to be racist, cancelling them, and then signalling to everybody else, look what happens when we accuse you of racism. Don't get me wrong, this guy might be racist, and the comments he made about Diane Abbott were crass, were crude, were a bit stupid, really. Right. But I'm more interested in how this guy seemingly made an investment. Now, of course, I'm not naive. This is how it works, right? But it's filthy, isn't it? So you give 10 million quid to the Tories, and you are given contracts to work for the NHS, Department of Health and Social Care. Apparently, he called a meeting of his foreign workers to address allegations of racism by former employees in 2019. This happened on a crowded balcony at his headquarters overlooking a railway line in Leeds. And he asked on the crowded balcony if there was no room for the Indians then. And he said, climb on the roof, like on the roof of the train there. Like I said, this guy sounds like a bit of an idiot. Whether he's fundamentally, deeply, you know, racist, if he's racist in his mind, in his heart, I have no idea. The Labour Party making great, they're making hay while the sun shines, as I said yesterday. Okay. The Times. Migrants to be paid thousands to move to Rwanda under new scheme. This is the much maligned, much mocked Rwanda scheme. The government wants to send migrants who come to the UK, who are not given leave to remain in the UK, if they cannot be sent back to their country of origin because they might be in danger or other reasons, well, let's send them to Rwanda, right? The government struck a deal with the Rwanda government earlier this year. Nobody has been sent to Rwanda yet. I don't believe anybody ever will be sent to Rwanda. It's now been revealed by the Times, wait for it, that under this scheme, people can receive financial assistance worth up to £3,000. I have no doubt, it is now 6:23 as I record this, that by 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, the Conservative broadcasters, GB News and Talk TV, will be full of this particular story. It is farcical. The Home Office says this voluntary Rwanda scheme is a way to remove migrants from war-torn or authoritarian countries where it cannot currently operate return flights such as Afghanistan and Iran. No planes will ever take off, in the opinion of this BBG. It's ridiculous. What a headline. What a headline. Migrants be paid thousands to move to Rwanda under new scheme. No money for public services, but money to send people to Rwanda. Yeah. Let's look inside the Express. UK towns, sudden spike in adult baptisms after asylum seeker influx. Again, you're guaranteed. Talk TV, GB News will be all over this today with presenters wringing their hands and shouting down microphones. I just laugh at this, to be honest, because everything we're talking about today is part of a distraction plan so that people will spend their days on forums and Facebook and Twitter arguing about these issues while the Great Reset agenda just kind of trundles on. Trundle is a great word, isn't it? UK town's sudden spike in adult baptisms after asylum seeker influx. The town in question is Luton, which according to the Express saw a massive rise in the number of adults baptised by the Church of England at the same time as there was an influx of asylum seekers to the area. Analysis of publicly available data from the Diocese of St Albans shows the local deanery had nearly twice as many adults than infants christened for the first time ever last year, 2023. This spike was predominantly driven by one church, All Saints, which baptised 35 adults, having only had five similar ceremonies combined in the decade before. So five in the previous 10 years and 35 last year. The Express writes, "We know the church has been baptising asylum seeker converts because the Reverend David Kesterton posted about it on social media. Back in 2022, he wrote on Twitter that, quote, it was wonderful to celebrate the baptism of three of our Iranian friends who are currently asylum seekers based in a local hotel. This was followed last year, 2023, by Reverend Kesterton revealing in another post that the church had baptised and confirmed 23 of our Iranian friends. Now, the Express contacted All Saints Parish to ask the Reverend Kesterton to explain these posts and the spikes in baptism. The Express sent him an email. He said to the Express, send me an email and we'll arrange an interview. But then he rejected the invitation to the interview and he referred the Express to the Bishop even of Chelmsford and the Archbishop of Canterbury. The church, whose list of registered parishioners has more than halved since 2012, is in a town that has had a 10% decrease in those who identify as Christian. It is also based in a heavily Muslim area where, according to the Express, Palestinian flags can be found fluttering outside many local businesses and is situated a very short distance from a hotel housing migrants. The Reverend Kesterton. Again, I've already said it, but there'll be much hullabaloo, there's another word, on this issue, I suppose, on the Conservative talk shows today. The Times, this is important. NHS bans puberty blockers for children. Children who want to change gender will no longer be prescribed puberty blockers on the NHS. This is good. And the Tavistock Clinic in North London is closing down this week, isn't it? Which is also good, in my opinion, that is. Landmark guidelines, according to the Times issued yesterday, said there is not enough evidence that the drugs are safe and from now on they should only be given as part of clinical trials. So what do puberty blockers do? Well, they suppress the release of sex hormones that cause physical changes such as breast development or the growth of facial hair. They have been prescribed to hundreds of under-16s on the NHS since 2011 at the Gender Identity Clinic I've just mentioned, run by the Tavistock and Portman NHS Foundation Trust in North London, which is closing down. A review of this clinic by Dr. Hilary Cass, the review was published in 2022, warned that puberty blockers may permanently disrupt brain development and lock in children to an irreversible life-altering path of cross-sex hormone treatment. Very important intervention that was at the time by Hilary Cass. Maria Caulfield, the health minister, said, "We have always been clear that children's safety and well-being is paramount, so we welcome this landmark decision by the NHS. Ending the routine prescription of puberty blockers will help ensure that care is based on evidence, expert clinical opinion, and is in the best interests of the child." This is a very, very good move. It really is. It really is. Because I reckon a lot of under 16s, not all of them, but many of them, if you leave them alone and you say, okay, if you want to express your gender identity, if you want to, you know, adapt your clothing to reflect your gender expression, by all means. If you'd like us to use a certain pronoun, by all means, no problem. You know, let's see how it goes. I reckon a lot of those kids in their 20s would grow out of it, maybe. That's just my opinion. Let's look at some good stuff in the Times. Inside the Mirror, UK demands full probe after Israeli troops beat and humiliated medics in Gaza. Now, I spoke about this yesterday. This is staff at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis who say, they claim, they were blindfolded, stripped, beaten, humiliated by members of the Israeli Defence Force. One distraught doctor, according to the Mirror, claimed he was detained, had dogs set upon him, and was violently assaulted by a soldier. Another doctor said he had his hand deliberately broken by a soldier. They branded their treatment. Lawyers representing these doctors say the treatment was cruel and inhumane. They were soaked with cold water and forced into stress positions. The BBC was all over this, as well as the Mirror. A Foreign Office Minister, Andrew Mitchell, who is a deputy for David Cameron, the Foreign Secretary, he said, "We have seen these reports. I think a full explanation and investigation is required, and that is what the British government is pressing for." And they quote Dr. Ahmed Abu Saba, who works at Nasser Hospital. He was held for a week in stress positions, had muzzled dogs set upon him, and he had his hand broken by a soldier. Doctors were made to stand for hours, forced to lie on their stomachs for prolonged periods. He added there was a maternity building where interrogations and beatings happened, and it became a place of torture. Yes, of course, it should be investigated, and anybody found guilty of it, well, they should be put in jail for a very, very long time. But don't hold your breath waiting for that to happen. I want to talk, finally, just very briefly. I don't know if I can bring the story up because I've lost it. I had it here. It's very important. It's about the Labour Party and a promise by the Labour Party to allow a vote on assisted dying should Labour form the next government. I've got it here. Now, I'm very, very much against this. When I was much more of an old liberal lefty, I'm still very liberal. I mean, I've always been very interested in socialism, in real socialism, not the bullshit democratic socialism you get from the Labour Party and other parties like the Socialist Workers' Party. There is no socialism, and there never was. We've never had a socialist government in the UK. We've never had a socialist government in Ireland. I'm talking about a genuinely socialist government. Anyway, look, that's for another day. But I used to be in favour of it when I knew nothing. You might say you still know nothing, Richie. Correct. That's right. At least these days I'm aware of the things I know nothing about. But look, I used to be in favour of it. Yeah, it's a good idea. It should be a human right to end your life if you want. But it's problematic, and I'll tell you why I think it is in a moment. So Starmer says MPs will have a vote on legalising assisted dying if he is leading the next government. He would hold a vote in the next parliament, opening the door to the law being changed before the end of this decade. He had a private conversation with Dame Esther Ranson, the broadcaster. She founded Childline, you might remember. She has terminal cancer and has publicly said she was considering it, going to Switzerland to end her own life when things become a bit too much. So he said, right, we'll have a vote on this and the law might change. I've been against it since I have had the opportunity to speak with people who are against it, since I've become obviously a bit more open-minded about things that I used to have a very, I suppose, I used to have a very definite opinion on. I have a huge problem with it. What if the diagnosis given to the patient is wrong? Haven't we covered a million stories, those of us who've worked in journalism? You know, I've been in journalism since 1998. Like, I mean, haven't we covered 1,000 stories of medical malpractice, doctors being proven wrong? That's a starting point, right? The diagnosis, the prognosis. The prognosis as, you know, doctors telling you, predicting basically, guessing about how your disease will progress. What if they're wrong and the patient is not going to die soon? What if the person who believes they are terminally ill or that their quality of life is going to deteriorate, what if they're receiving bad medical care and that in reality their suffering could be helped or relieved by other means, complementary medicine, for example? What if the doctor is unaware of the options that I've just mentioned? You know, palliative care that has improved, or complementary care, energy healing, which has been proven to work. You know what I'm talking about, right? What if the doctor doesn't know about that or these things? What if the person who wants access to euthanasia doesn't really want access, but is actually crying out for help? You know, that while his or her life might not be worth living now, but it could be worth living if various problems or fears they're having are managed, maybe. What if the person is depressed and believes things are worse than they are? What if the person is confused and unable to make sensible judgments, or has an unrealistic fear, basically, of the pain and suffering that lies ahead because they've read about these things in the papers, or because culturally they've, you know, heard conversations about you know, the pain of cancer and the pain of being terminally ill? Maybe they don't understand that that's not exactly what's going to happen, that, you know, that these things can be managed. They're feeling vulnerable. They're feeling that they are a burden on others. That's a huge one, that. You know, somebody who feels they are a worthless entity now and a burden on others and on their family, that they're causing anguish to their family. Maybe they feel under pressure from other people to feel that they're a burden. How can you deal with that? You know, how can you manage that? If you're going to legalize euthanasia, how can you be absolutely certain that the person is absolutely convinced this is the right thing, and not for all of the reasons I've just outlined? Very important, isn't it? Very important. Won't it reduce, by the way? I've often wondered about this. If they legalise euthanasia, won't it reduce the availability of palliative care in the community, won't it? That's a good argument, isn't it? And it's been made by those who are against euthanasia, that if you introduce it, it'll reduce the availability of palliative care in the community. Why? Well, they say, the opponents, because health systems will want to choose the most cost-effective ways of dealing with dying patients. That's an absolute given, isn't it? Euthanasia. I remember a disabled person said to me one time, it allows euthanasia to send the message that it is better to be dead than it is to be sick or disabled. The underlying subtext being that some lives are not worth living. It puts the sick and disabled at risk, and it downgrades their status as human beings while they are alive, if you allow euthanasia. Absolutely right. I think it's one we'll be returning to on the Richie Allen Show, as and when Starmer's government attempts to bring a bill to the House of Commons to be debated upon and then voted upon. Listen, that's it for today's edition of The Papers. Thank you for listening to it. I hope you have a good Wednesday, whatever it is you're doing. You might want to catch up with me later on, because at 4 o'clock UK time, I'll be on air with today's Richie Allen Show. So in the meantime, bye from me. Bye now.